is the news.
Headlines: French police use force to disperse angry protesters following a deadly suspected racist attack on a Kurdish center in central Paris. U.S. House of Representatives approves a new $45 billion aid package for Ukraine. This will bring Washington's aid to Kiev to almost $100 billion. And Border Force staff at U.K. airports join nationwide strikes by workers in various sectors, prompting warnings of delays for air travelers. Hello, everyone, and very warm welcome to World News. Police have clashed with protesters in the French capital, Paris, after a deadly shooting with a suspected racist motive on a Kurdish center. Protesters gathered near the site of the shooting, hurling stones at police, security forces, and fired tear gas and attempted to disperse the crowd. French President Emmanuel Macron called the shooting an odious attack. The Interior Minister has reinforced police protection of the Kurdish community sites in Paris and elsewhere throughout the country. A 69-year-old has been arrested in connection with the shooting, which left three people dead and three others injured. Suspect was known to authorities and had a history of racism and attacks on foreign nationals, especially Kurds. The U.S. House of Representatives has approved a $45 billion aid package for Ukraine. Military and economic assistance is part of a $1.6 trillion government funding bill that had passed the Senate. It will now go to the U.S. President Joe Biden's desk to be signed into law. U.S. has been Ukraine's main military sponsor in its war with Russia. It's already sent aid worth around $50 billion to Ukraine this year. Russia has repeatedly warned, though, that foreign military aid for Ukraine will only drag out the war and escalate human suffering. The war in Ukraine has plunged Moscow-Washington ties to their lowest in decades. The Russian ambassador to the U.S. has compared the state of relations to the Ice Age, warning of a high risk of a clash. The Russian foreign minister has called for de-escalation in the Armenian-majority Nagorno-Karabakh region, that after the only link between the region and Armenia was blocked by so-called Azerbaijani activists. Lavrov said that he hopes the movement along the key road will be restored as soon as possible. He made the remarks following talks with his Azerbaijani counterpart in Moscow. The corridor, which is a key supply route for food, medicine, and fuel, has been obstructed since last week by a group styling itself as environmental activists. Now, Armenia says that they're backed by the Azerbaijani government to create a humanitarian crisis in the mountainous enclave. Baku, however, has accused the Russian peacekeepers of closing the road link. Azerbaijan Republic took control of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region after the 2021 war. From nurses to teachers to railway employees, British workers in various sectors have been staging back-to-back walkouts since summer. And now air travelers in the country are warned of delays as passport control staff go on strike just ahead of Christmas. A public and commercial services union says over 1,000 Border Force staff walked off the job Friday. This is the first day of their industrial action, which is due to last until the new year, as they are dissatisfied over pay and demanding raises. According to the union, the government's 2% raise offer just does not keep pace with double-digit inflation. Industrial unrest is expected to upend travel plans in the coming days. Britain's busiest airport, Heathrow, says passengers should be prepared for travel disruptions. The UK is reeling from strikes over pay and working conditions, that amid a cost-of-living crisis combined by fears of a recession.
2022 has been dominated by a cost of living crisis, and the figures are staggering. Inflation is running at a double-digit pace, the highest in 40 years, and far outpacing wage growth. While food prices have shot up almost 20%, and the cost of heating a typical home has jumped more than 150%. As temperatures plummet below zero and desperation rises, key sector worker unions have launched mass strike actions to pressure the government to force wage rises.
The people who are out here on strike today are the same people who not only worked through the pandemic, we worked for the people. We'd get their prescriptions, we'd get their milk and bread.
We just want a pay rise in line with the cost of living. At the moment, what we're getting is actually terms of a pay cut. So it's not even in line with inflation. Everything's gone up. We're just like everybody else. We're all struggling.
This is not about pay. This is about our jobs.
The situation has become so dire in Britain that many families will have to choose whether to heat their homes or feed their families this Christmas.
It is very distressing. It's a situation which, in a way, unimaginable for a country which is supposed to be one of the richest countries in Europe and in the West. Why is it we have these extremes of poverty? Why are people, some people, forced to choose between heating and eating? I mean, there's something completely wrong about our system. We should be plugging and supporting and promoting equality and, you know, not oppressing the poor. You know, there's something which says a lot about our political system, which is flawed.
The government has pinned much of the blame on economic recovery from the COVID era. However, critics say its ruling Conservative Party incompetence and leadership instability that has also left the economy in a dire state. A lesser discussed reason for a European-wide crisis is the ongoing Ukraine war. Britain has remained a staunch supporter of continued fighting, even upping its shipments of arms and financial support.
I think the first is ensuring that we deliver more military aid and that that military aid evolves to meet the situation that we're now facing. And that means more air defence systems, it means artillery, it means armoured vehicles. For our part in the United Kingdom, we've pledged to match or exceed the £2.3 billion in aid that we provided this year, next year.
Low wages, higher fuel costs, inflation and major strike action have all marred 2022. Does the government have what it takes to resolve these many issues in 2023? Probably not. It's going to be a long road with most likely higher taxation, major cuts in public spending, and renewed pressure on an already struggling British working class. Robert Carter, London.
A U.S. congressional committee probing the 2021 attack on Capitol Hill has unveiled its final report incriminating former President Donald Trump. In the latest edition of our news review program, we discuss the report and its implication on Trump's bid for re-election.
On this segment of the program, a U.S. congressional panel probing the 2021 attack on the Capitol building has released its final report. It accuses former President Donald Trump of inciting the deadly riots and engaging in a conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election results. The 800-page report is based on more than 1,000 interviews and hundreds of thousands of documents, as well as federal and state court rulings. The report indicates that former President knew he had lost the election, but still pressured officials and his deputy against the vote outcome. He then directly summoned what the committee calls a violent mob and refused to ask his supporters to leave. The report is made public just days after the panel asked the Justice Department to charge Trump for four crimes, including obstruction and insurrection. It's the first time Congress has referred a former president to criminal prosecution in U.S. history. Trump dismisses the committee and its report as a political witch hunt. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Colin Campbell, who's joining us from Washington, also from Madison. We have editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. It's Kevin Barrett, if you may. What are the implications of this report? As Colin mentioned, it's nothing new, but now that it's all in writing, it could make a difference.
Well, I think Colin's right that, you know, Trump probably has more people against him than for him at this point. And some of those people on the Republican side will be stealth opponents. They won't be actively, openly working against him, but they, again, as Colin said, they'd like him to go away. And then, of course, then there's the Liz Cheney faction of Republicans who are vociferously anti-Trump, the never-Trumpers. So, yeah, I think he's now in the minority in Washington. In a sense, he always was. Trump was an outsider president, and that's part of the reason this happened. He's viewed as a disruptive outsider by the permanent national security state, and it's regardless of what you think about many of his decisions and actions, quite a few of which were completely crazy. He did shake things up in Washington and paid the price, and now we have an extreme polarization going on in the electorate and in the country in general, where the narratives that we're getting are not very factual on both sides. We're getting this story of the insurrection from the committee and its supporters, when in fact what really happened was that 99%+ of the people there were peaceful demonstrators who were concerned about the election integrity issue, which actually is a huge issue. And indeed, there's a very strong case that a number of American presidential elections have indeed been stolen, most obviously 2000, when a bunch of Republican thugs terrorized the vote counters in Florida, and then the Supreme Coup ruled in favor of Bush and Cheney. And then in 2004, most likely, according to all the polls and the best data, Kerry actually won at least a 3-point, possibly as much as a 6-point popular vote mandate and an electoral vote decisive victory, which was stolen from him by Karl Rove's friends, who, like Mike Connell, Karl Rove's election czar, who oversaw what almost certainly was a massive computer vote fraud theft of that election from John Kerry, which Kerry, the skull and bones companion of Bush, was probably okay with. So we have a real problem with our elections in this country. The Democrats have long been in denial about this, even though they're the ones who actually were robbed, worse than the Republicans. Historically, people should look at Jonathan Simon's work for the details. So what we have right now is a bizarre situation where suddenly there's a group that's upset about election integrity, and it's the Republicans who've actually, that's the party that's been stealing most of the elections. And then we have the party that says, oh, none of this ever happens, that's, you know, completely in denial, and that's the Democrats. And they're both putting out these mythological narratives that are have very little to do with fact. So I think that, you know, we're really in a crisis right now in the United States. Belief in the, you know, faith in the political system is at an all-time low. Faith in the media is at an all-time low. And something's got to give. I don't know what it's going to be.
Colin, do you think that this will ultimately lead to Donald Trump being ineligible for the next presidential elections?
Yeah, if he is indicted, it definitely could be. A lot of people feel that's mixed. I mean, there are large implications for indicting a former president. Will this become some type of weaponization of the intelligence agency and, of course, the Department of Justice for future former presidents? There are some implications there. Others say, listen, justice needs to be done here. There were some serious grievances and some serious malfeasance that was accomplished here, and that needs to be taken into consideration and acted upon. And I think that there are more people who think that the latter will be the overlying wisdom here than the former, because if something is not done, this could also send a message for future politicians who want to engage in unlawful practices or unconstitutional actions, and they would go unpunished. So I think that there's a high probability here that the Department of Justice will bring charges, but it's unclear how that will go forward from there.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Colin Campbell joining us from Washington, and Kevin Barrett, editor of Veterans Today, joining us from Madison. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but stick around, there's plenty more to come.
And welcome back, everyone. Northeastern part of the United States is witnessing a surge in COVID cases as millions of Americans begin their Christmas holiday travels. Highly contagious Omicron subvariant XBB is now accounting for more than half the cases. XBB is estimated to make up more than 18% of coronavirus cases in the U.S., up from around 11% the previous week. And the holiday travel could speed up the subvariant spread across the country. Now, this is while the government says that updated COVID booster shots, which target Omicron and some of its subvariants, do not provide optimal protection against the XBB subvariant. Thousands of flights have been canceled in the U.S. as a massive winter storm brings airport operations down to a crawl. Nearly 7,000 flights were canceled Thursday and Friday, leaving holiday travelers frustrated. The FAA, that's the Federal Aviation Administration, imposed ground stops and delays to de-ice a number of airport runways. As a result, some 4,000 U.S. flights were also delayed on Friday. Poor weather conditions have also disrupted railroad travel throughout the holiday season, forcing the cancellations of dozens of trains. Japan's decision to boost military spending has drawn strong rebukes from civic leaders in South Korea. Tokyo argues its move to build up its forces comes amid threats from North Korea and China. Tokyo's arms purchases will also provide a boon for U.S. weapons manufacturers. Frank Smith has your story from Seoul.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that, more than $300 billion, is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that's it for your latest. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
American unilateralism, trade wars, and U.S. sanctions against various countries have caused various countries to consider abandoning the U.S. dollar for their trade. The ongoing trade dispute between United States and China, as well as illegal sanctions imposed on China's major current partners such as Russia and the Islamic Republic of Iran, have forced these countries to take steps to reduce their dependence on the U.S. dollar. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia Today has covered this story and tells us more. Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak told the Russia 24 TV channel recently that energy trade between Russia and China has been steadily growing and is up 64% in monetary value so far this year. Alexander Novak's comments followed a meeting of the Intergovernmental Russian-Chinese Commission on Energy Cooperation. He said China is our strategic partner in the Asia-Pacific region and generally in trade, noting that in physical terms the increase was about 10% in supplies of oil, gas, coal and electricity. Russia's Deputy Prime Minister explained that the two countries aim to further develop their trade relations and in particular are working on expanding the share of national currencies in energy transactions. Alexander Novak said we're switching to settlements in rubles and yuan for the energy resources supplied. In recent years, Russia and China have been ramping up the use of domestic currencies in mutual settlements in an attempt to move away from the US dollar and the euro. Moscow has been steadily pursuing a policy of de-dollarization of its foreign trade and has in particular increased use of the Chinese yuan. In addition to the Chinese currency featuring more frequently in trade settlements, some Russian companies have begun issuing yuan-dominated bonds, while a number of banks are offering deposits in the currency. According to Alexander Novak, the national currencies have also been used for the purchase of various equipment from China. He said in the near future, Moscow and Beijing are expected to sign an intergovernmental agreement on the Far East gas export route. Negotiations between the two countries also continue on the Power of Siberia 2 megaproject to further increase the supply of Russian natural gas to China. Iran's Tasnim news agency has also covered the same story. When Russian President Vladimir Putin visited Tehran in July of 2022, the Kremlin leader's first foreign trip since Moscow's special operation in Ukraine, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, emphasized that the U.S. dollar should be gradually taken off global trade, and this can be done gradually. On the same day, in a symbolic act, trading occurred between the Russian ruble and the Iranian rial on the Iran currency exchange, with the first trade occurring on 19th of July with a 3 million ruble or $48,000 exchange. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Moscow and Tehran will gradually abandon the practice of using U.S. dollar to assess the scope of their bilateral trade. Referring to the Russian President Vladimir Putin's recent trip to Iran, Dmitry Peskov said, "We all know that trade and economic relations between the two countries slightly exceeded $4 billion U.S. dollars last year, although it may be wrong to count it in U.S. dollars, and over time we will probably move away from this practice as we develop our cooperation in the banking and financial sector." Dmitry Peskov added, "Moscow and Tehran are reliable friends and business partners." Peskov also said that the net trade between Russia and Iran grew 31% just over the last few months, adding that the trend is positive. According to him, Russia and Iran have an opportunity to build cooperation to mitigate the effect of U.S.-imposed sanctions. Dmitry Peskov also expressed hope that a cooperation agreement will be signed shortly after some amendments are approved. He concluded by saying, "We hope the deal will be signed soon after some additional changes are made and agreed upon, taking into account the opinion of Iranian officials. It will be possible to sign the deal fairly quickly and in the near future." India's Mint newspaper has also covered the same story. The head of the Federation of the Indian Export Organizations, FIEO, Ajay Sahai, said on Monday, 19th of December, India will start using the rupee in trade settlements with Russia starting over the next few days. The two nations will be testing a new payment mechanism for the first time since it was approved by the State Bank of India, a state-owned commercial bank, last September. The Indian government permitted the national currency, the rupee, to be used in international trade settlements recently in an effort to promote exports and reduce the rupee's dependence on the US dollar. India's central bank, the Reserve Bank of India, had earlier called on Indian lenders to introduce additional arrangements for import and export transactions in rupees. The head of the Federation of Indian Export Organizations, Ajay Sahai, told Mint newspaper, "A number of issues have been sorted out. Exporters and importers have begun approaching banks for opening of accounts. Settlements between Russia and India will reportedly be carried out using the so-called Vostro accounts. A Vostro account is typically opened at a domestic bank on behalf of a foreign bank and keeps the latter's holdings on deposit in the currency of the country where the money is deposited, in this case the Indian rupee." An unnamed government official told the media outlet, "About 10 or 11 Vostro accounts have been opened up." The official specified, "For instance, there are 6 Vostro accounts opened in IndusInd Bank, which means 6 different Russian banks have opened accounts in the bank. Settlements in Indian rupees are expected to help boost trade and simplify Russian oil supplies to India, which have risen substantially since last March." Russia's Izvestia newspaper has also covered the same story. According to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, the Eurasian Economic Union, the EEU, is going to drop the US dollar it is used for the calculation of its trade statistics and switch to another currency. Sergei Lavrov also called the Eurasian Economic Union one of the fastest developing organizations in the world. Lavrov said, during a conference, Eurasian Choice as a Basis for Strengthening Sovereignty, "There are about 185 million consumers in the Eurasian Economic Union, with a gross income of about $2 trillion. We need to switch to other currencies in calculations of our trade, although we're still doing this in US dollars because of inertia. No doubt this will change in the near future." Sergei Lavrov said, "Vietnam and Singapore have already signed trade agreements with the Eurasian Economic Union, the EEU, while Iran and Egypt are expected to do so in the near future. Moreover, the Eurasian Economic Union is planning to start trade negotiations with India, Indonesia, and the United Arab Emirates."
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a new episode of Back to Reality. Hope you're doing great and everything is just fine with you. Now that we have your precious attention, buckle up to fly beyond the surface of the most interesting topics. You are listening to us from IRIB English Radio. This is Asma at your service as the host, and here with me I have two very dear guests who are going to accompany us through the realm of reality. I hereby welcome you both to Back to Reality. Welcome, brothers. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you very much. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for inviting me to your show.
And thank you for coming here. And you, brother?
Assalamu alaikum warahmatullah. I hope
we have a good
discussion.
Inshallah. Well, as the ritual of this program goes, I would love you both to introduce yourself and give us a very brief introduction about your field of study and the rest.
I'm Ali, and I've been studying philosophy, Islamic philosophy.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And you?
I'm Muhammad Hussein Rajabian. I'm a PhD candidate for Islamic studies.
Great. Yeah,
and I'm doing my Kharij studies as well in Hosa Seminary School.
So I guess today we're going to set the table on fire. It has always been a long debate for all the people all around the world, and everybody talks about poverty and the causes and the effect of that. Now, I would love to start it with my own question. Is poverty a matter of questioning justice in this world?
From the maybe creation of Prophet Adam on the earth till today, and maybe in future we will deal with this important subject, the poverty, that it has been of such an importance that caused many changes in the world in different, you know, turning points during the history. So as well, it was a subject that has been used as a pretext for those who were, you know, looking for power to use it to mobilize people under this umbrella. And through that, they get to their own, you know, ambitions and purposes and goals. From another point of view, if you look at it, so this was kind of the social point of view. But from another point of view, I mean the religious point of view, in all the religions, almost we have it, as we have had it in Christianity, in Judaism, and in other religions, which this poverty was a subject matter in the great scriptures and the Bible. As well, we have it in Islam as a very important subject, that some of the main obligations of Islam, some of the obligatory things in Islam, are focused on this special point, as we have it about almsgiving, whether it is the wajib almsgiving, you know, obligatory almsgiving, or the recommended one. We know them as sadaqah and zakat.
So we know that it exists, but is it a matter of questioning justice?
Yeah, of course. So because the one of the main things that the religion is looking for that in our lives, I mean, human life, is justice.
Yeah.
So poverty, I mean, it means that there are different social classes. Mm-hmm. So people are not the same in their, you know, monetary ability, fiscal abilities. So because of that, to establish the justice in society, Islam has many rules in this regard. I mean, to somehow compensate this lowerness of this, for example, class, the poor people, the poor community, and brings them up to kind of levelize between different group of people.
Yeah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Okay, brother.
Yeah.
I love you.
Social justice and justice was among the main goals and objectives of the prophets of God and messengers of God,
yeah,
in the course of history. So in case they started to establish a government, they were often actually bringing justice to the people. So what contradicts this justice? One of these elements can be poverty. So all the divine and Abrahamic, let's say, messengers were fighting against this unpleasant phenomenon in the communities and societies that they have been living in. Poverty might have many reasons, and sometimes lack of, let's say, efforts and perseverance of people,
yeah,
could be the cause of poverty. So
they sit idle and they expect everything to happen by itself.
And we have it even in hadith and narrations, you know, from Imam Ali alayhi salam, that says that when people start to work and actually get distant from laziness, the poverty will be removed from,
yeah,
the scene of the earth. It can be one of the reasons. But there are many different reasons, or let's say forms of poverty as well. We not want to actually say that all of these different forms of poverty are due to laziness or lack of perseverance.
Exactly.
What some of the forms of poverty are due to the, let's say, circumstances that are available in a society, sometimes like the imposed economic pressures that are in some societies, or some say, as we have again in the hadith, that when the committing of the sins actually increases, the poverty actually also increases with that.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be a sort of relation between the amount of the sins that people commit with
exactly.
the poverty. So all in all, this is something actually against justice. And
but nobody chooses poverty for himself or herself.
Definitely. No one chooses this poverty for himself. As I said, it might have many different reasons, extravagance in our daily activities, in israf, what we have in as a, let's say, catastrophe in our lives, could be, again, one of the reasons of poverty. Poverty actually targets justice, and it is the duty of the people themselves, the leaders, and also whether, I mean, religious or, let's say, governing leaders
to interrupt you. Just to make it very much clear about israf, what do you mean by that?
Actually, israf is just lacking a program in using something in our daily lives. I mean, when we are actually trying to misuse whatever is at our hand. Extravagance.
Yeah.
Whatever is at our hand, but we do not actually see the value of it, and we sometimes actually use it more than it is needed, and sometimes it is due to the lack of, as I said, program and planning, we actually try to misuse some
exactly.
of the blessings of God.
Yeah. So just to wrap this part up, I would say that, sometimes poverty is not the thing that I have chosen for my life. It has happened as a test in my life. And we all know that all societies need balance, and we have it in our religion that if people help each other, if the rich people, if those who have enough of affluence help those who are in need, help the poor people, the needy people, then there would be a balance in society. And as you just talked about extravagance, if we just stop that, if we think properly, if we have a program for our life and for the money God has blessed us with, then there would be no poor in this world. Now, before we get into the effects of poverty, let's go for a short break and we'll be back. Thank you, dear listeners. Welcome back. You're listening to Back to Reality. Well, in here with Brother Alavi and Brother Rajavian, we're having a quite perfect discussion on poverty. Well, we talked about the reasons and how it happens, and actually there are different sorts of poverty, and of course, just for the record, the most horrible poverty is the poverty of the soul. But aside from that, the physical poverty is going to lead to very horrible effects that might happen to everyone. And many people say that corruption has a major root in poverty. We see in many societies that the people who are poor, after some years and after decades of their life, they start to be the most important people of their society, and they start to flourish and accomplish different things and great things, let's say, in their societies. So what happens that a group of people turn to be sinners or wrongdoers coming out of poverty, and some others are just the other way?
We cannot say the poverty is the full reason or a complete reason for the things, I mean, the outcomes that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
That we
but
say
it
that
could be one of the main reasons.
It could be one of the reasons, but we cannot say that because that person was, a poor person. So because of that, he has become a wrongdoer or a sinner.
No, because we have it even in our narrations.
So
that when poverty comes, many things leave the house.
Yeah, of course. I said I'm talking about, a full reason. Yeah, it could be a part of reason. So you can see that many of the great people, maybe even in our Islamic societies, when you look from the early Islam till now, some of the greatest figures that we have had in Islam, they came out of a very, very poor, you know, family.
Yeah.
We cannot say that when the poverty enters a house, then everything will leave that house. So we say that when this family is poor, then the results 100% will be that the person, a child that comes out of this house, he will be a rind, you are a sinner.
Mm-hmm.
Or a sinner. As I told you, well, from the beginning, early Islam, the greatest companions of the Holy Prophet and Imam alayhi wasalam, when you look at them, you see that they were from the poorest, classes of society.
Yeah.
May I correct something here? Because I think there was a sort of misunderstanding from what I explained earlier. Look, as I said, poverty might have many different reasons. So one of those reasons might be, committing sins or, I don't know, acting wrongly or being lazy in the work, in our daily activities. So as I said, the collection of reasons might lead to poverty. So it's not the only, and as the brother even pinpointed, it's not the only reason for
that. Yeah, but it is one of the major ones.
Definitely. It can be one of the reasons, yeah.
Just as you both said, poverty, we cannot consider it as the total reason for all the wrong things that happen in the world.
Yeah.
But it is one of the major ones. And there are some who believe that necessity is the mother of inventions. Mm-hmm. So could we just say that poverty is going to lead into goodness? I mean, is there any way to say that poverty is a blessing in disguise? So from all that's been said in this discussion, as in today, well, I could get that. Poverty could be considered as one of the main reasons for many wrong things that happen in the world. But still, we cannot say that all those people who are in poverty are going to be wrongdoers, sinners, or whatever, because we see it in history and we see it in different societies, in different nations, with different cultures and background, that many people coming out of poverty, and then they turn to be great figures of their societies. So there's no way to put it this way, that poverty equals sinners, equals all the wrong things that happens in different cultures and societies. And after all, it's a test, and people can make the best out of everything because we have a brain, we have logic. And God would help those who would ask help from himself. So that's it. Thank you. This is all the time that we have for today's episode. Until a next episode, I will bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaykum
as-salam. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim. يا ربي لدي أمار عزك يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك لتصي دليلتك once again.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime should be included in the annual list of shame for its violations against Palestinian children. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, more than half of the population living in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are below 18. In fact, one can confidently say that half of the people of the occupied West Bank and besieged Gaza Strip are children. Anyone who wages a war against these two territories through house demolition, arrest without trial, shoot to kill policy, and humiliation is waging war against children. At times, whole military brigades of the Zionist regime army, accompanied by elite units, border police and police, chase a boy and, in most cases, kill him or at best arrest him. If there is anything that changed in the last few years in what finally the United Nations was willing to call the colonization of Palestine, it is the intensification of the Zionist regime's shoot-to-kill policy. And although so many of Palestinians understand that the new Israeli regime cabinet will not change the policies the previous cabinets pursued, one can expect further brutalization in the war against the people of Palestine. The news has reached us of murder by the Zionist regime troops of Fula Ramsi Abdul Aziz Al Musalama. She was on her way to celebrating her 16th birthday. She was with others in a car near Beitunia when the Zionist regime troops, without any reason, opened fire on the car and killed her. Needless to say, the Zionist newspaper reporting the incident blamed the driver and did not even bother to mention her name. The killing of children is not a new aspect of Israeli policies toward the Palestinians. By April 1948, the Zionist regime military leadership of forces began to strategize more clearly its policy towards any population that would be left in the villages they occupied during the 1948 ethnic cleansing. One of its clear guidelines was to either kill or send to a prison camp, at the discretion of the commander on the spot, men at a fighting age. The command clearly defines what is meant by men, anyone above the age of 10. Very much like any destructive Israeli regime policy since the massive expulsion and killings of 1948, a new method of incremental piecemeal action and policy became the norm. It is a very deceptive policy, as whomever you want to alert is faced with a killing of one or two persons every now and then, and the dots are not easily connected to produce a damning indictment. This was true in the early 1950s, but of course, since then, the numbers are massive and this incremental killing is far more visible. In November 1950, the Zionist regime army shot dead three children ages 8, 10, and 12 from the village of Yalo, while in 1952, the Israeli commando murdered four children, ranging from ages 6 to 14, in Beit Jala. A year later, among the five shepherds the Zionist regime killed in February 1953, one was 13-year-old boy from Alberg. The incremental infanticide at times is replaced by a more intensive killing of children. During the First Intifada, according to the Association of Israeli and Palestinian Physicians for Human Rights, Every 2 weeks, a child under 6 was shot in the head by the Zionist regime army. During the Second Intifada, 600 Palestinian children were killed. Among them are the 12-year-old Mohammad Ad-Dore, the 14-year-old Faris Odeh, and 11-year-old Khaled Al-Mughrabi. 5,000 children were wounded. In 2007, the Israeli regime air force killed 8 children of the Shahada family in Gaza. In the first wave of the attack on Gaza in 2008, more than 300 children died, and another 30 in 2012. At the highest death recorded in 2014, with more than 550 children. Put differently, since 2000, 250 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli regime army and security forces. This is equivalent to the killing of nearly 45,000 children in Britain by military or police force since 2000. Why is it so important to record these grim and horrifying data and define clearly its legal and moral significance? For a few reasons. First, the fact that only here, in an alternative media outlet, you will be aware of these atrocities is an indication of the hypocrisy of the Western media and political elite when it comes to Palestine, compared to the compassion shown toward children in Ukraine. Secondly, these figures accentuate the existential threat Zionism still poses to the Palestinian people and their future. It is not only land that the fabricated regime of Israel covets, it is intent on continuing the destruction of the people themselves. But most important than all is the infuriating exemption of Palestine from the international discussion of the mass killing in general and that of children in particular. Take, for example, the international definition of mass killing. It is defined as the deliberate actions of armed groups, including but not limited to state security forces that result in the death of at least 1,000 non-combatant civilians targeted as part of a specific group over a period of one or less. In the First and Second Intifada in 2009 and 2014, the number of Palestinians killed by the Zionist regime exceeded by far 1,000. Nowhere in the UN or another human rights organization recording mass killings worldwide do the Palestinians appear as a case study. The game is not of numbers, of course, but much more about the ideology that facilitates such mass killing, a kind of inhumanity, only possible if the humans you target are dehumanized, an ideology that leads in many cases to genocidal policies. The definition of genocide, according to Article 2 of the UN Charter on Genocide, includes mass killing, bodily and mental harm, and physical desertion as indicators of such policies. The report of the Special Representative of the Secretary General in October 2009 and updated in November 2013 lists 6 grave violations of international human rights law regarding children's rights in armed conflict. There is no armed conflict in Palestine, and yet 3 of these grave violations occur daily in the colonized West Bank and occasionally in massive numbers in besieged Gaza Strip. Killing and maiming of children, attacks against schools and hospitals, and denial of humanitarian access. Some of the Israeli regime policies enacted during the siege on Gaza in terms of denial of food, energy, and above all medical help create a criterion by itself that should have been added to this document. In August this year, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet expressed alarm at the high number of Palestinians, including children, killed and injured in the occupied Palestinian territory since the beginning of 2022. She was referring to the killing of 37 children from the beginning of the year until that August, and was particularly horrified by the killing of 19 children in 1 week, she stated. Inflicting hurt on any child during the course of conflict is deeply disturbing, and the killing and maiming of so many children this year is unconscionable. Meanwhile, Press TV reported the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called on the United Nations to include Israel in its annual list of shame for its violations against Palestinian children. In a statement on the occasion of the World Children's Day recently, Hamas urged the world body to pressure the Tel Aviv regime for the immediate release of all Palestinian children being held behind Israeli regime bars. The resistance movement also called on international human rights groups to protect the Palestinian children against the Zionist regime. The UN marks the World Children's Day while the suffering of the Palestinian children who are exposed to the most heinous forms of crime by Israeli war machine and a systematic racist policy is ongoing, the statement read. Elsewhere in the statement, it said about 3 dozen Palestinian children had been killed by Israeli regime forces during the current year and 160 others suffer from various forms of psychological and physical torture in Israeli regime prisons. The Palestinian Prisoners Society, PPS, recently said Israeli military forces had arrested more than 750 Palestinian children during arrest campaigns across the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds since the beginning of the current year. The PPS in November 2020 highlighted rights violations committed by Israeli regime forces against minor Palestinian prisoners. The youth are often abducted from homes in the middle of the night, detained for hours without food or drink, and verbally abused. Israeli regime prison authorities also forced the children into confession by threatening to torture them. Interrogations are done without the presence of a parent or a lawyer. In May 2020, a study found that the Zionist regime had arrested up to 16,500 Palestinian children since the outbreak of the Second Intifada in late 2000. The Detainees Affairs Commission of the Palestine Liberation Organization also revealed recently that the Israeli regime had detained over 50,000 Palestinian children since the occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds in 1967.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.